Well, Melina's our director of public programs.
Yeah. I'm director of public programs and have been at the HR for now about 8 years. I'm predominantly curator and informer, but I have never worked with Benefices works about. I personally think that he's probably one of the most amazing sculptors of the 20th century. And I'm going to be very personal about it, and I will also bring references that are sort of objective. And I'd like us to have a discussion. I have to tell you that every time when I see this sculpture, or any sculptures by Brancusi for that matter, I have an extraordinary, always sensual and visual experience. I cannot quite believe that the sculpture like this could exist. And so I want to have a discussion with you today as to what do you think about the sculpture? What roles the pedestals play? Is the pedestal part of the sculpture? Or is the pedestal a pedestal? There have been enormous amount of writings about Brancusi, and particularly about this aspect of his work. I'd like to start maybe a very shortly just to tell a little bit about his background and biography, and quote also one of the major art historians, and I'm just not giving you his name because everybody says the same, is that art of Constantin Brancusi is one of the supreme achievements of modern sculpture. So when we are looking at it, you know, let's keep that in mind. And he himself said, love of material is psychological, not a sculptural affair. So I think that's very interesting to me as well. Now, who is Constantin Brancusi? He was born in Romania in 1876 to a very poor peasant family in Carpathian Mountains. The place was called Hobita in Gori. His parents were very hard-working peasants. He was one of six children. He was the fourth in the family. He was working already with farming, with working with animals, probably from the age of nine. I think this is not unusual. Most of the people who work on farms, even more recently, they involve their children. He was, by many accounts, very intelligent and always interested in carving. What is fascinating about the carving is that this particular area is known for amazing craft work, very traditional, and the villages themselves were using wood in most of their sculptures, always carved. I didn't bring any big books that are, of course, available in our library. We just picked up a few things. And this completely caught my imagination when I looked at this, you know, the sort of rough carving. But you can imagine that it all surrounded him all the time. Apparently, he was thrown from school for a short period of time, for when he was about 8 or 9, because he started carving into his desks. And of course, he was disruptive. He also left home at the age of 9 because his son was a poet. But it also shows that he was an independent and in many ways very inspired. He went to a nearby town and found different kind of jobs and kept himself going. He carved furniture. He carved tables. He apparently also carved an amazing violin. And one of his employers, when he was at the age of 18, decided to pay for his schooling in Craiovia School of Art, which really in translation says the local school of craft. He graduated with honors in 1898 and then went directly, again supported, to the Bucharest School of Fine Arts, Bucharest being the capital of Romania. After he graduated again with honors and had his first sort of exhibition of his work, he traveled on foot and by different means, first in Munich, and Vienna. And then later on, he went on foot and other ways also to Paris, again, that sort of thing. How an amazing thing that he traveled on foot. Well, it was very common at the time when people traveled through Europe, they would be traveling on foot. Still, you have to be sort of very inspired to do so. He arrived in Paris in about 1904, kept himself going also through all kinds of labor work, working in the restaurants, washing dishes, and all these kind of things. At the same time, he started to work in the studio of Antonin Mercier. I'm not familiar with the work of Antonin Mercier. He also established his own studio and was invited to enter the studio of Daniel Rousseau. However, he refused to go there, saying it's very hard for a young artist to work in a studio of established artists, meaning, you know, it's hard for a young tree to grow under a small tree. So we can again see his determination, but also his very strong belief in what he was doing. By the time he met lots of other artists, and some of his friends included Apollinaire, Pablo Picasso, Fernand Léger, later on also Eric Satie, Tristan Tara. He was also a very good friend of Duchamp, with whom actually he kept friendships throughout his life. By 1908, he was already established as a sculptor and has begun to show. What were Brancusi's interests? So again, going back to sort of think who Brancusi was. He was very much interested in science, in the music. He was actually a singer and a performer, which of course is again not unusual, knowing that he came from a Romanian village where singing, music, carving were all, you know, very typical. He was on furniture in his studio. What was the culture milieu within which he existed? Of course, there was an enormous amount of debate about abstract art among the artists. But what is it that caught his imagination in particular? It was the modern sort of contemporary phenomenology, which is the vision of things of the essence, meaning what is the essence of object? What remains there after everything else is taken away? And of course, we can look at it intellectually. For him, everything seems to go through his enormous intuition and particular love of material. He strongly believed that one must be absolutely true to the material. You cannot do with it what it cannot, what it's not available for. You just follow material, you don't really turn it into something that it cannot do. So here we now arrive, I think, also, we can discuss his method of working, which of course, looking at the at this particular sculpture, you can see that there are lots of different elements that he's working with, but also that he's addressing it in a very different way. We have the bronze top of the torso, which is highly polished. We have stone marble that is like a cube. And then, of course, we have wood, which is geometric, just like marble. And, I mean, it's not as beautifully polished or as beautifully done as the torso on the top. What was also unusual about him at the time is no artist at the time really carved their own sculptures. They worked most of the time, they had assistants, and actually him, by carving his own work, then later on inspired other artists, for example, like Barbara Hepworth or Henry Moore, to really carve their own sculptures. So now we come to this question, you know, what is it that we are looking at? And why do we have this debate that is going still on, and artists are still trying to, you know, address his work? Like, what is the sculpture? What's the pedestal? Is it one thing? Or could it be moved around? Or what it would be what it would look like if it was to be separate. He, of course, has devised this sculpture this way. He believed that it has to have this particular pedestal. So let's talk about, you know, what is your feeling when you're looking at this work? Could we take the torso away? And we know that there were, I think there are four different examples of this work. You know, he also was, once he get an idea of a particular work, whether it was torso of a young man or the bird in flight, which you can see at the National Gallery here, he would work on the particular theme until he felt he mastered it. Or until, probably, he still had an inspiration for the work. Like, The Bird in Flight was done, I think, 36 times in different material. The torso of the young man is done 4 times. It started by torso being made of wood from a branch, and then later on. And so there are 2 examples of wood and 2 examples of bronze. And one bronze piece had the stone part, but didn't have the pedestal. So I want to open it to our discussion as to what do you think, and could we separate it, or do you really feel it's together, and is this pedestal, or is this a sculpture, the wooden part?
I have a question. When you said there are 2 bronzes, so does that mean this is an addition of 2, or are they separate bronzes?
You know, I don't think he has ever looked at any of his work as an addition, because every time he did it anew. And then, of course, this cup is a cast, and the cast is taken from the original wooden sculpture. But the fact how he polished it, or how he shaped it in the end, it's always different. He never really looked at it as copies of a copy. Because each one he was trying to resolve a different feeling, and also wanted to know whether he can come to something that is absolutely perfect in his view, meaning total essence of thing, rather than a representation of something.
It was not done in plaster original, it was done in wood, right?
It was wood of which there was a plaster copy. Yeah, thank you.
I think his viewers were kind of trained to ignore the pedestal, to ignore the walls that art is on. So it's easy just to look at the bronze and think, that's the work, and kind of ignore the pedestal. But because the artist did part of himself and kind of ensure that it would be viewed this way, I think it's an important part of the work that we shouldn't just view it as a pedestal.
That important part of the work, okay.
Is he the first artist to make his own pedestal?
You are a waste ahead of the curve.
Yes.
And there was a reason. So what are the other opinions?
But then he wasn't the first artist to, I mean, this becomes almost a type of installation because it's not just the object, it's the object and then the space surrounding the object, because we've moved down to the floor. He's certainly not the first artist to play around with installation like that. I mean, he's working with Duchamp in a way as well. No?
He was really and of course for me, I just brought these photographs with me. And these are photographs of Bernard Cousy in his studio and of his works. So we can also see how he looked at things. For me, to tell you the truth, this particular portion is extremely disturbing.
Right.
And I know that we in the museum have to have it, because, of course, it's a popular museum. Or I haven't seen it. I really haven't seen it in recent years, particularly in North America, without the base, because we tried to protect the work. But when there was an exhibition, his first major exhibition in the United States, which was in the Guggenheim Museum in 1955, when he was still alive, it was 2 years before his death, I modeled as a small photograph that I was able to find in one of the publications, when it really did stood in the middle of the room, and you can really work walk around it, right on the floor. You know, another kind of thing to think, and I don't know whether this is just anecdotal or whether it's essential, is Brancusi was quite short. You know, I've always imagined Brancusi to be a really tall man because all of his photographs, I don't know whether they're any here, show him as a major figure. Maybe it was in my mind psychologically, because I always feel that the sculpture is monumental, and of course it's not monumental, but it's monumental in terms of its presence and in terms of its influence. He really hated pedestals in the museums, and of course we are now, when we think about Brancusi, we are in the first part of the 20th century. So let's think about pedestals in the first part of the 20th century. Regular museums, you know, probably dark and slightly, always sort of slightly crafted. He felt that pedestals really destroy the works of art, and felt that it would be almost better not to have a pedestal and just have the work of art directly on the floor, even if it was small. So his determination was to make his own pedestal so that nobody can kind of play with it in any other way. So let's return back to our discussion about
it. Well, can I ask, what would you think if this had, instead of this pedestal on the bottom, if it had like the lines around it?
Yeah, I totally agree. I also think that that's kind of a work. And again, it's my personal opinion, needs to be right in the middle. He actually, towards the end of his life, was thinking of creating some kind of machine, turning machine, on which the sculpture would stand and sort of move. Right. And he also said that, which I'm not incredibly thrilled about, but it would have been sort of interesting. He said that works of art, or his works of art, are not really about understanding them. It's really about experiencing them. And I think that sculptures are always about this profound experience. You know that these different parts, I checked with our senior curator, Valerie Fletcher, they're not really attached to each other. They are really positioned on each other, which is another amazing thing to take into consideration in terms of sculpture.
Are the wooden parts separate too?
I don't know. I couldn't find that. I don't think so. Because when you look at how he produces works, they seem to be in one piece. Mm-hmm. He loved wood, you can tell. And of course he also produced from wood tables and chairs. One particular amazing piece he made, I think, or presented in Romania back in 1938. It was a monument to World War I, which is in Târgu Jiu. It has Table of Silences, and what it is from stone, in that case, I think, a table, and these sort of, not chairs, but it's almost like blocks to sit on. So you can also see that he could play with any of that part on its own, and would also determine how to use them individually, though in this case they are together. So of course he was playing with all these ideas, from the art pieces to utilitarian pieces that could be actually used, and that had also profound influence on artists. One of our docents, who I really love, told me that she loves the torso, but she finds the two other pieces really disturbing, taking away from the top piece.
But she likes the torso just on the stone, mm-hmm. is that it?
Yeah. Or maybe completely on its own.
Okay. Because otherwise, wouldn't you say there are three pieces? Would how do you see that pedestal? As composed of three pieces or two?
Good question.
No, that side it doesn't seem like a pedestal at all. Yeah. You couldn't put the...
So, yeah. John, what do you think? Is it one? What do you think?
Because I was thinking you could even just call the bottom part the pedestal, so you can't figure it out.
That's right. That's right.
So, Frank, whose view was the one who did the infinite column, or was the piece? Mm-hmm. What view was that done in relation to this piece?
Sorry, which one?
The infinite column.
Infinite column. Very close. Very I don't have exact details, but we can probably find it. You can quickly have a look at this book. But I'm sure it will have it there.
1920.
But again, there were series of them.
Yeah.
He started first with the wooden endless column, which I think was, I'm working meters, 7 meters. So I am 1.70 meters, so you can probably see that it's kind of reaching this. The ceiling. He also made one in Romania, I think, from stone. So once he got an idea, and I think it's good to talk about endless column, which indeed would be something like the bottom, and with no sculpture on the top, it's just going. So you could see how he was experimenting with all of these elements and thinking about all of them, how they can stand on their own, how they interact.
They're all geometric shapes, too, and you could kind of relate them.
Exactly.
The torso to the...
Yeah, somebody also said to me there is a clear sense of cubism.
Yes,
maybe.
Yes.
There. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I have never thought about it as cubistic because I was always thinking about his heavy influences. Mm-hmm. Crafts.
Yeah.
If you look at crafts, they do have this sort of geometrical elements.
But it's top heavy. This is what interests me.
Top heavy.
The very bottom piece is in scale with the very top, but the second cube is bigger.
Yeah.
And normally you would stack.
It has a heavier feeling.
I mean, even more than that, you have the wood, which is, it's a heavy material, but it's nothing compared to stone. And bronze. I mean,
I think that unconsciously when we come across this, you sort of know all of this, and that's what is so surprising about the series, right? Because in a way, when you look at it, it doesn't feel it's forced, or that you should be afraid that it's going to fall. I mean, there is something very natural going on. It's amazing the balance. There were two artists that I found that were had said something additional about all this that may be of interest to us. Richard Serra, and we do not have a work on view, unfortunately, now. Richard Serra, in last year, meaning 2011, had an exhibition in Bayreuth, which is in Switzerland, of his work and Berkus's work together. They each had, we have a wonderful publication in the library. There were galleries only of Richard Serra's work, and then there were galleries of Berkus's work. If I wanted to see one exhibition in my lifetime, I would have liked to have seen that one. And sort of, at first it was kind of obvious to me why Richard Serra did it, because I thought, of course, all artists would want to exhibit with Brancusi, all sculptors. But he had to, of course, also define it. Why? And it's very interesting how he did it. He said that, and it made perfect sense, and I think it will make also perfect sense to us. He visited the studio of Brancusi in 1964 and 65 and made an enormous amount of drawings. And, again, the studio is so well represented in this picture, so if anybody wants to look at it in addition, here it is. As we know, Brancusi died in 1957, and the studio was completely preserved with 1,200 photographs and 215 sculptures, meaning different objects. It's very close to the Pompidou Center. He gave it to France because Romania at the time was communist and refused to get any gifts from him. He has, of course, been by this time accepted to academy and so on. His pieces are there as well. But everything went around, so it's sort of available for the visits of anyone who wants to make a visit. And so Richard Serra went there on many occasions and was totally fascinated by the work. And he said, Brancusi work is a handbook of possibilities. I never thought, and I quote it, I never thought about Brancusi's works as being about placing artifices on top of bases or art objects on top of bases. I always thought the entire structure were sculptures, and that there were not just configuration of elements on bases. The kind of intention that went into carving of one structure had to do with the discipline of working on another. And then he says, Brancusi pieces achieve weightlessness. And I think this is exactly what we were discussing, right? One does not sense force of weight acting. If the pieces are equally balanced, their weight is cancelled out. You have no thought of tension nor of gravity. And he said it's almost like looking at work in suspension. And of course, that's what Serra wanted to achieve with his work as well. Because when you go and see later on in his career some of the pieces that we can experience or walk through, you also have the sort of feeling, of course, he is threatening, that it will fall on you. With Brancusi, you never have the sense of being threatened or charged or anything like that. So you walk through Serra's work and they are tilted. So obviously the same kind of idea transferred into sculpture in the late 20th century is there. He also wanted to place his work on the floor or on the ground. And again, it's been said that Brancusi really strongly influenced Giacometti, because Giacometti then created the sculptures which were placed directly on the floor. And he greatly influenced minimalists, because you know, when you forget about the top, what do you have, right? Minimalist sculpture. So again, you get the idea to go and see Dan Fleming at the end of the galleries on the second floor. So that was his huge influence. Other artists, you know, played with the idea of Brancusi in a different way. I knew personally Scott Burton. Scott Burton died of AIDS, I think, in the end of the 80s. And if you go to the National Gallery, there are two amazing pieces by Scott Burton. One, as you enter the atrium, that's like a big bench made of stone, granite. And then there is something almost like this Brancusi's silent piece for the heroes of the First World War, which is in the National Gallery Sculpture Garden. It's again a table with the chairs, this time with something that you can lean on. He did something extraordinary. At the Museum of Modern Art, they have many of Brancusi's sculptures. And he got a commission, Scott Burton, the year he died, to do a direction show. Direction shows would be as big as probably this space. And Kurt Van der Rohe, who was then a chief curator, or maybe curator of modern art, contemporary art, allowed Scott Burton to do something that Scott Burton always wanted to do, is to have sculptures on Brancusi's and dismantle them. So there would be a head, one sculpture lying on the floor. So you could really take each individual piece together. It's a great credit to MoMA that they have done it, because, you know, museums are a little bit like mausoleums, and we are not really prepared to experiment. And I think we should. And it was great that Scott Burton was allowed to do that. It was a very interesting response from the critics, because they credit him for doing it, but of course also said this is a dangerous move. You know, but any experimentation, of course, is dangerous. And why did he want to do it? Scott Burton was basically interested in dissolution of aesthetic boundaries between utilitarian design and sculpture, and you know, work of art. And he believed, and he was really interested only in utilitarian sculpture, but trying to prove that utilitarian sculpture is a fine art. And so he worked with Brancusi's work to point out to us again that though, you know, coming back to pedestal, you take this away, you leave the pedestal, it's actually not a pedestal, it's a work of art. It's kind of interesting to follow all of this sort of discourse and how it's going on. However, there was one artist, William Tucker, who declared the bases are not works of art in Brancusi. So, you know, it's very interesting that there are all these kind of debates. By now, of course, I think that hardly anybody would really question it. But I think as we look at the work, we should question it and sort of think of the different, you know, why is it like this? Which, of course, what comes into mind is first his media and the period of time that he worked with, and he's surrounded by his kind of contemporaries. On the other hand, we should look at it at the time that we are alive, and of course interpret it depending on what we already know.
I have a question about symbolism. Do you think there's any symbolism in the fact that the torso, just the torso, has no head, no arms, and no legs?
Well, no genitals.
Or does it go to head in some way?
Asked this question because I found some material and wanted to talk about it, and I thought it would take away from the base. He was interested in antiquity, both Greek and Roman sculpture, but more than anything else, he was exposed to Cambodian sculpture in Paris from the first half of the 9th century. I tried to get some images from Google, but I couldn't. You know, you always give me the text, not the images. However, I found in one book an image, and I, of course, forgot it on my desk. And it is also of a young man. It's made of sandstone. It's perfectly polished. It's totally idealistic. And it also doesn't show genitals. You know, there are two interpretations. Most of the writers and curators who wrote about Brancusi up to now, but maybe more up to the 70s or 80s, talked about the fact that that in itself is a genital organ, right? And he had a great sense of humor and played with these kind of things. On the other hand, if you think that Brancusi wanted to strip the subject as well as object to the essential, you know, when you think of a young man, I don't think we are thinking of genitals. We are thinking of a certain kind of a strength and beautiful posture. You know, you... I probably finished it then.
What? The relationship with Duchamp, like that irony where you can read it as being a torso or genitals. So it's a torso without genitals, but it could also be without with genitals.
I know, you know, when we met him, Duchamp was much younger than Brancusi. So again, I don't know, maybe Brancusi had his own, or you have found something there, maybe Brancusi had his own, you know, understanding of things. And it's not that he was not sexually active. Man was incredibly, sexual. He was incredibly active. And some of his work was removed from exhibitions, particularly of women sculptures or representing women, because they look like phallic organ.
I'm flipping through this and found this sculpture that's in the Philadelphia Museum. It's called Torso of a Girl, and it was done around the same time. And
right.
I think it's an interesting comparison, just because it's I don't know, it makes me question even more the symbolic nature of this torso of a young man. It's mm-hmm. no particular answers, but just an interesting comparison.
It is. He was really moving more and more. I mean, what he was also obsessed with is this flight of bird. And if you look at the bird, it doesn't look like a bird. It's an essence. Mm-hmm. And it's an essence of movement. Mm-hmm. And the bird that inspired him is a bird, I think it's sort of mythological kind of a bird. Phoenix, right? And when you think of phoenix as sort of breath and giving hope, looking into the future.
Rising from the ashes.
Right. You don't see the wings, right? You hold on to ideas so much. Yes, exactly. So again, it's the same with torso. For me, probably fascinating is also his obsession with kind of the most simple form, air, which he called beginning of the world. Or if you look at some of his, which I haven't seen in person, or if you look at some of his depiction of a baby, you know, just the face or a head, it doesn't seem to have eyes or anything. Of course, you know, we don't question it there. We probably need to think of the bodies as sexualized bodies.
We have sleeping cues.
We have sleeping
cues. Is that on you now?
It's on you now. We have three sculptures. We have Sleeping Moons, Prometheus, and the torso. Mr. Hirschhorn was offered many more of his sculptures, as I found from our archives. And I don't know why he didn't buy everything that he was offered, because all the pieces that he was offered early on in 1961 are absolutely exquisite.
From a jeweler?
Yeah. So to me it's a little bit of a puzzle. I don't know whether it was because of the price, because he liked to negotiate. So we have three sculptures and we have, I think, two or three drawings. We feel here in the museum.
It's pretty good, actually.
It's extremely good, yeah. Probably the interpretation here in this museum is that, you know, you show the most exquisite example of a particular artist. But there are other possibilities. I kind of think that it's a duty of a curator really to think how to allow the audiences to learn about the work. And then there are possibilities of exhibiting next to the most outstanding work in the collection, also other works. It really is a question of how you work with the space. And when I see at the National Gallery this fantastic selection of Marcuse's, as well as MoMA, several of the larger pieces together, I sometimes almost feel that one takes from another, because though they have a space, they don't really have a space. I feel like that kind of work would actually be with another of the pieces, just completely on its own, in the space, just to experience it properly. But
so two of our three sculptures are on
view
right now.
Prometheus, it's a very small, and there's always feeling that it gets lost.
It's a bronze. And Sleeping Muse is out in the gallery?
Yes,
and
it's
in the
second floor.
Yeah.
Second floor. Which is also an exquisite piece. Mr. Hirschhorn wasn't too keen, I mean, I can finish any time, too keen on lending to Princess. I don't think we lended to Documenta, which really established, I think, but here is the, I don't think I have it here. Yes, it was later on. So we didn't lend to Documenta, which usually takes place in Germany, because we're worried that something would happen to the sculpture. But we do lend to a major museum, such as, you know, I don't know how many years. No, we didn't lend, really. You know, that's really interesting. We probably don't lend these sculptures so easily.
There aren't that many Brancusis. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a small body of work, isn't it? Didn't he make very few works?
Well, in Paris, they say there are 220 left. But, of course, I don't know when you say 220, whether we talk about individual pieces that could consist of a column or a base or whatever, or whether we are really talking, which I don't think we are, about 120 sculptures.
In the whole room?
No, in his particular studio. But I think there are plenty of publications that you can look at and see where these sculptures are. There also, he did his own photographs, and there are plenty of photographs also around him. In this particular publication that you are looking at, this big Nice discussing, he's a photographer, again, Brancusi photographs. So, you know, Brancusi somehow never loses the fascination. Thank you.
Thank you very much.